Well, thanks again for having me. It sure is a pleasure to be here. And so I'm Bruce Pardo, and Dennis, we've already been introduced. Gosh, that was a lovely sit. I just have to tell you, I really appreciate it. A great group, good room, and so nice after, what a day, kind of a crazy day. We're having a lot of those lately, I think. So I'm hoping that tonight's talk actually can be somewhat of a support in needing. Gosh, it just seems like there's a lot going on, and somehow we have to find a sense of balance and I think a sense of direction. And so that's what tonight's talk is really about. And really sprang from back in 2010. I was on a 3-month retreat at IMS, and back on the East Coast in Massachusetts, and had the good fortune to be interviewing with Joseph Goldstein for the whole 3 months. And so in the morning at like the 8:15 sit, they would allow 15 minutes for a question and answer period. Joe, it was the teacher who had given the talk from the night before, would do the question and answer. And Joseph had given the talk the night before. And there was this young man who was sitting behind me, and I'd noticed him. He's very young. It turns out 19 years old on a 3-month retreat. And pretty cool. Anyways, he got up, and it was interesting what came out of his mouth, because I'd been watching him, walking and things like that. And I never have any judgments on retreat. But the thought just flew through. It's like, gosh, that guy looks like he's really straining. He's pushing. His practice is kind of tight. And anyways, he gets up in a very sweet and soft voice, and it turns out he's practicing metta. And this was about probably more than halfway through the retreat. And it just struck me, here's this guy, 19 years old, 3-month retreat, and he's doing nothing but offering love all day, every day, every waking moment. That's his intention. And his question was a very sincere and earnest question. Joseph, can love get me all the way there? Because Vipassana is known as a wisdom practice. And Joseph's response, part of it, was something that totally struck me. There's a T.S. Eliot line. It goes, genuine poetry can communicate before it is understood. And this was something that just landed for me. And Joseph said, there's this amazing yogi, Deepama, who from India and Burma, and she attained to very high levels of enlightenment very, very rapidly, and was an extremely skillful master who was around at the time she came out to IMS in the early days. And he said in a conversation with Deepama, she had said, Joseph, at a certain point, love and wisdom become one. And I was just struck by that. It just landed inside of me, and it just kind of resonated in my bones. And so, of course, my heart mind started fiddling around with that. And it's just something that, as it has landed and rested in me over the years, I found that this is not just the purview of highly enlightened beings. It's something that we know. It's something that we are. We get it. And it's so exciting to me that it's really very accessible to us. And it's just the way that truth resonates. But I had an experience of this actually 3 years prior to that on my first, it was my second retreat. It was a month-long retreat. And led by Jack Kornfield and John Travis and a couple of other teachers at Spirit Rock. And Jack, in one of his Dharma talks, told a story that it just... It was another one of those moments. I remember I was so up in the Nevada City area, up above there in the North San Juan Ridge area is the Malakoff Diggins, which is the kind of, in this particular area, that's almost like an alluvial wash where they had hosed down the mountainsides looking for gold. And very much of a, still a moon-like landscape, but not a lot of vegetation growing. Kind of makes you wonder why. But anyways, I was out there for the Perseid meteor shower one August evening with a friend, and we brought out these folding lawn chairs, and we were looking up, and she said at the beginning of the evening when it got dark, she said, "Oh, there's the North Star over there." And a few hours later in the evening, I looked up and all of the constellations had been moving except for the North Star. And I was like, wow, how about that? This is all in a sense, you know, it is north. We're rotating around an axis. And this story has become kind of an axis around which my life rotates, or the message of it. So anyways, I'm going to tell this story in the same way that Jack did. And so thank you, Jack. But that's the way it landed for me and had a lot of meaning, so I wanted to share it with you. Anyways, and some of you may know it because he shares it a lot if you've listened to his talks. He was over practicing in Thailand, and one of the people he was practicing with was his fellow Mahagosananda, who was from Cambodia and became the kind of head figure, the patriarch of Buddhism in Cambodia. And at the time of the Khmer Rouge's genocidal rampage, he and Mahagosananda were traveling outside the country. And every single member of Mahagosananda's family, direct family, 17 people were killed. And there was a death, you know, he was, Mahagosananda was on a death list, as were most of the monks and intellectuals and, you know, people that could cause trouble. And so it was impossible for Mahagosananda to go back into Cambodia. And so what he did is he went into the refugee camps in Laos and Thailand. And as they were traveling, one refugee camp, Mahagosananda said, you know, what these people need is they need the Dharma. And so what they did is they set up a makeshift platform and passed out flyers all through the refugee camp. And they found out that the Khmer Rouge had infiltrated the refugee camp, and they threatened that anybody that would go to the Sangha gathering would be killed, and their family back in Cambodia would be killed as well. So on the appointed day, they had no idea if anyone would show up. And so they were waiting on the little platform, and slowly but surely 25,000 people, basically the entire camp, showed up. And and Jack was looking out over this, you know, sea of shattered faces that have just been through a genocide. You know, you have these big ebullient Cambodian families and, you know, reduced to a grandmother and a grandson or an uncle and a niece. And Jack was wondering, you know, what could he possibly say to this, you know, extraordinary amount of group trauma, collective trauma. And so what Mahagosananda said was really startling in a way, because implicit in it is forgiveness. He said the Buddha's words from the second verse of the Dhammapada, which are, hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law. And he started chanting that, and French and Cambodian. And slowly but surely, 25,000 people who'd just been through a genocide started chanting it with him. And so, you know, in that moment, you know, love did heal hatred. And it just was one of those moments of like, wow, that is such, I know it's a truth. I'm not sure quite how yet. And as I thought later, you know, I thought, well, when I feel hatred, I feel coldness and contraction. When I feel love, I feel warmth and expansiveness. You cannot relieve a cold contraction with more of the same. You know, it's kind of almost like thermodynamics. So this is really actually a law. You know, just like gravity is a law. What if humanity recognized this as a law of how things are? You know, our world would blossom. And this was the this was the seed crystal that led to the formation of AskLove.org, and an idea of, you know, gosh, if we're going to learn how love heals hatred, we need to be able to hold our conflicts and challenges and still maintain an open heart. But I know, and you know, recently I've been in a very difficult situation in my own life. And it's been, there's just been times where literally the whole front of my body has been completely contracted, and there's just not, you know, there's just not access to my heart. It's shut down. And so the idea for Ask Love is a practice that I want to share with you later. But if we can't access the wisdom in our own hearts, maybe we can put our issue out there with people that aren't contracted as we are and have them reflect from their hearts. And I don't know if you've heard of crowdsourcing, but this is kind of like heart sourcing. So that love can heal, you know, our challenges, hatreds, conflicts. And that's the intention of that site. So thanks for mentioning it, Dennis. I think, you know, when we speak of wisdom and love, or when we speak of wisdom in our tradition, one of the key areas in which we hold wisdom is the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering, not self, and so, you know, just the fact that everything's changing moment by moment, and if we try and grab onto it, and if we need it to be a certain way for us, if we can't accept how it is, then we're going to get burned. You know, it's going to slip through us and it's going to burn us. We're going to suffer. And then also to find and see, as we look directly and clearly at our experience, that there's no one behind the curtain pulling the strings. You know, it's happening of itself due to causes and conditions. You know, if I, what just popped into my head is, if I'm a stamp collector, probably I have a lot of thoughts about stamps and a lot of things look like stamps. You know, it's conditioning. So anyways, you know, from a wisdom perspective, you know, let's look at impermanence through the lens of love. And really what love sees is love sees the constant flow and connects with it and recognizes the preciousness of it. It cares about it. And it sees that because it's fleeting, that is a cause for care and concern. And I love the Buddha's very short quote. He said, our time is too short not to, no, knowing life is short, how can we quarrel? And I love that. You know, it's just, wow. let's show up for this and embrace the change. And another...
Could you repeat that?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Knowing life is short, how can we quarrel? So when we know that life is short and precious, we're attending to it on a moment-by-moment basis, on a change-by-change basis, embracing and attending to it all. And that's what love does. It meets things intimately. And they say that, the highest form of love, certainly that a child wants, it's not all the great toys in the world or, schools or so on and so forth, but just there's parents, attention and presence, really. And so love, attention and presence can be the highest form of love. I believe it was the Zen master Isa who took this to an extreme level of seeing the preciousness of life. He, on the death of his beloved, very, very beloved daughter, he said, dew evaporates and all the world is dew, so precious, so fleeting, so dear. So that connection, that preciousness that love holds, drops us deeply into change. I love from Helen Keller the quote, security is mostly a superstition. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing at all. And love has this capacity to embrace and see the energy of our changing lives and embrace that energy, whether it is beautiful or challenging. When it's beautiful, there's a sense of joy. When it's challenging, there's a sense of compassion and support. I know for myself, with this kind of whole body shutdown, even though it's been really hard to access my heart, in the midst of that, there's something about just being in the field, and there's the patience of knowing that compassion will be there to hold it. Compassion sneaks in the door. So that's been a real support over the last few days, a real support. I love that the title of Philip Moffat's book, Dancing with Life. Love dances with life, moment by moment, change by change. I think from the perspective, if I'm going to say not self, impersonality, if I take away the person, what am I left with? I'm left with all of it, And so it's this inclusive unity, sense of union. And, love is selfless by default. Love is selfless in nature. When we truly love, we're dropping agenda and just meeting the moment as it is and as it presents itself. And that's an extraordinary gift to ourselves and our world. I love the quote from Martin Luther King. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And we know this so deeply, especially for those of you who are here supporting the Sangha or supporting other causes and conditions. It's when you give of yourself to the collective, to the whole, that you actually receive. And this is a basic understanding from the perspective of love. And lastly, I'll say just about suffering, that love, from the eyes of love, from the eyes of the heart, love cares too much, it cares too much about harm being done. So when we attend to our experience with a sense of love, there's a sense of acceptance, and there's a sense of, you know, what causes us to suffer so much is that we're pushing away what we don't like or trying to pull in more of what we do like, and so we're constantly rocking back and forth, and it's really stressful. We're rarely just in the center and feeling balance and like, oh, I can just take it easy. I'm content, full, right? And it's that seesaw back and forth that stresses us out, and, you know, we get neurotic. And one thing about, you know, this has been one of the things, and this is so alive for me right now as these last days have unfolded, and that is, you know, there's a true, it's like, okay, so this energy is really, really present a lot, you know, in different ways. It's changing all the time. But instead of pushing it away, there's some kind of a deep confidence that even though it's very persistent, and when I'm not paying attention in detail, it seems like kind of a unified, unchanging thing. But if I just attend to it and let it be as it is, you know, I'm noticing some softening, I'm noticing some, it moves through. And I kind of look at it, you know, the way that a parent might be with a child. You know, if you have a child come to you who's upset, what do you do with an upset child? You know, if you say, you know, you probably bring him in, put him on your knee, or you're, you know, comfort them. You're curious what's going on for you. You explore and investigate. You allow them to be as they are and help them settle and calm down. If you say to that child, hey, it's not okay for you to be the way you are. I don't like what you're saying. Go back to your room. I don't ever want to hear from you again. You're just going to end up with a much more freaked out child. And it takes a certain sense of loving acceptance to welcome in the, you know, the ogres from the basement. And, you know, they can be pretty big at times. So love has this naturally inclusive quality to it that is agendaless and impersonal. It'll take, you know, the salt and the pepper. The other thing, though, that I think about is, you know, where love and wisdom arise. Wisdom arises from seeing clearly, out of awareness. Interestingly enough, so does love. You know, we use the metaphor for awareness. And your Thai forest model here, or no, Mahasi Thai style blend. So, you know, in the Mahasi, it's just moment of consciousness, moment of consciousness, moment of consciousness. In the Thai forest tradition, there's the idea of, yes, there's object consciousness, but there's also an uninstantiated consciousness. So it's either a whole bunch of moments of consciousness put together that make up our awareness, or there's both an uninstantiated awareness or consciousness and an object consciousness that make up our awareness. But I love the metaphor that's used in the big mind meditation of our awareness, our minds, the nature of mind, being like the open sky. And then the objects that arise are like clouds that pass through it. So if I, you know, this sound is an object arising, passing through the space of our minds. If your eyes were closed, would it be inside or outside? You know, it wouldn't matter as far as awareness is concerned. You, yourself, and everything around you is all passing through the open, spacious quality of mind. And I love that because when I think of the sky's relationship to the clouds, it is an intimate and direct contact with all of them. It does not judge them. It accepts them all. And that, to me, is the basis of love and certainly of the Brahma-Vihara of Upekkha or equanimity. And for me, I find that's the meeting point of the heart and emptiness or awareness. And you can almost see how from this place of just a basic, there's an inclusivity And what I've noticed is that inclusivity is the basis of care, the basis of warmth, the warmth of the heart. And so when, you know, when the heart encounters something from that place of equanimity, there's a natural friendliness. And if that then encounters suffering, there's a natural compassion, there's a caring, a wanting to alleviate, you know, a movement towards, Thich Nhat Hanh says, compassion is a verb. Or if it encounters joy, there's joy for that joy. Wow, joy, cool, yay, mudita. So truly in that way, you know, looking at awareness as the basis out of which, you know, kind of all of this stuff's happening, then we can see how love and wisdom are united at the level of awareness. this is all great. It's helpful to me because I'm very much of a head type. I've really had to work on coming down into my body, into practice and into my heart. Uniting, you know, wisdom for me started up here. And what I've recognized, though, is that as powerful as my intellect, you know, the intellectual reasoning capacity of mind is, it sees things in pieces and parts. Whereas the heart quality of mind sees a unified whole. And that's how reality actually is. So wisdom is not a product of our reasoning and rationality. Wisdom is a product of connectivity and inclusivity. You know, we get our most skillful answers. That's why when we lead from the heart, we have our most profound answers. And just ask folks like, you know, the Dalai Lama or Gandhi or Mother Teresa, Aung San Suu Kyi, Nelson Mandela. You know, these were people that many people would associate as being both incredibly wise and very loving, really truly guided by the heart, as if they didn't even have a choice. So I just wanted to offer, you know, in these times that are so challenging and triggering, there's a practice that I've offered on Ask Love for people to be able to get in touch with their heart's wisdom in a sort of a quick and easy way. I call it heart fluency, and because you're learning how to hear your heart's voice and express it. And so it's got three steps, and they're called stop, drop, and ask. And you might remember stop, drop, and roll,
yeah.
Right? What you do when you're on fire. They teach it in the schools. You don't want to go running off because that'll just fan the flames. You want to stop, drop, roll to the ground, you know, roll around the ground. Well, with stop, drop, and ask, the first thing to do is stop and recognize you're on, you know, on fire with a conflict or challenge, right? I mean, you can also, you know, stop and recognize you're on fire with the joy or, you know, or happiness. But just stop. You know, and then connect with what it is at some level, and then either just drop your attention into your heart space, a mindful awareness into your heart space, or drop the situation into your heart space and see how it lands. You know, in with our mindfulness practice, what's the direct sensation of it? Is it warm or cool? Is it expansive or contractive? Is it heavy or light? Is it hard? Is it soft? Is it tingling, vibrating, stabbing, pulsing? You know, I even like to look and see sometimes there's a color associated with it. And you're just getting that direct, unmediated, non-conceptual connection with the aliveness of the situation as it lives in you right in the very moment. And then what you do, and that's basically an abbreviated version of, you probably, a lot of you have heard the acronym RAIN, recognize, accept or allow, investigate in the body, and nourish, you know, with, or the N is also used as non-identify. So when you stop, you're recognizing and you've pulled back, you've all of a sudden taken some observation, you're kind of in a mindful, you know, observational perspective at that point. So there's a little bit of you've broken identification somewhat, you've non-identified somewhat. When you drop, you're allowing or accepting it by default, and you're dropping it into your heart, which is in your body, so you're investigating it in your body. But the cool thing about it is that you've dropped it into your heart. So all you're resourced by all the Brahma-viharas by default, right from the get-go. And some of this stuff can be pretty challenging, so that's helpful. And the heart really can be a portal to the rest of the body. But starting out in the heart and connecting with the aliveness in the heart just has this, it's kind of like a nice initial grounding, right? And then you may explore outside the heart a little bit and go, okay, I've got a sense of what's happening here in the moment. And when there is that sense and you feel like, okay, I'm curious to know what this, something about this, then with a sense of innocence and sincerity, you just open up, this is the ask part, you just open up to any guidance from your heart. And I was actually asking Donald Rothberg, senior teacher at Spirit Rock, who's been giving me some guidance on this, what's the Buddhist correlate for the ask? And he said, oh, that would be a koan. It's like asking a koan. So you just open up for any guidance, and it could be, what arises. You kind of allow your attention to be like a cat at a mouse's door at the heart space and see what emerges from that sincere, innocent inquiry. And it could be an image, it might be a memory, it might be an intuition, it might be a sensation, an emotion, it may even be words, it might be analytical. Whatever it is, the thinking mind, the discursive mind, immediately via perception goes, what's that? And it explores it, looks for meaning, and if it makes any sense, it supports and articulates it. And so often when we have a conflict or challenge, we either react and regret it, or we contract, like I've been doing, and spin up here, endlessly trying to figure out that which we can't figure out. It stresses us out. So when the heart speaks, there's a quote, when the heart speaks, the mind finds it indecent to object. But when the heart leads, the reasoning mind, the reasoning aspect of mind automatically follows and supports it. So now we're working with our full faculties, right? When we lead from the head, this is left out, and that's a big shame. Because when we ask the heart, it's like, what are we asking? It's like you might say, oh, this is intellectual, rational, reasoning, intelligence. A lot of people think that in this area of the is known as the Hara or Dantian is where intuitive intelligence lies. Some people feel like it lies in the heart. But you might look at the heart as relational intelligence. But I also think of the heart as, the seat of our basic goodness, of the good heart, which is often equated with Buddha nature, which is often equated with awareness. And so it all becomes one. And so when you're asking your heart, you're really asking a mystery. And the message that it delivers could be a gift from beyond. Who knows? I don't. To me, that's just, it's very exciting because it's like accessing an inner oracle in a way. And it can be a great source of a sense of clarity. And it gives the mind, the thinking mind, a chance to stop spinning. So that's kind of what I've got to. I've blabbed for a long time. But I'd be happy to open it up now and take any questions or comments, concerns.
So terms of the practice, stop, drop, and ask.
Yeah.
When do you suggest that we initiate that?
Thank you. So it's something that, you know, can be done in a moment. I actually have a little 2-minute video up on Ask Love. I was sitting in a movie theater one night, and I was like, I think there might have been one or two other people at the late show, and I was getting ready to watch Star Wars Rogue One. And so I was all settled in, and there's nobody behind me to kick the chair, and nobody in front of me, no loudness. I was right in the middle, not too far back, not too far forward. You know, it was just like, I had my own little nest. And so after the credits have played, the movie has started, you know, and I'm just starting to get into the movie. Three people walk into the theater, and, you know, I see out of the corner of my eye, you know, them walking up and down the aisles, and then they come over and they sit in the seats directly next to me. I mean, directly next to mine. And, you know, immediate, like, whoa! So I stopped, recognized that I was feeling aversion and judgment in the moment, like, what's up with these yahoos? And and then I dropped the situation, the contraction. Really, I dropped my attention into my heart, and I just felt the contraction. You know, and what happened, just upon recognizing the contraction, it kind of softened all on its own just by seeing it. And then I opened up for an answer, and what came out was words that came out kind of like a voice that said, well, what if you were supposed to meet these people here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, life sent them. And then there was kind of a sense of, I felt, you know, at the sensation level, some more softening. And it was like, ooh, that was cool. And then another thought arose. And that thought was, you know, these are perfect seats. And, you know, why wouldn't they want to sit here? So maybe I could, you know, have a sense of welcome and invitation like they're dear friends. And I mean, I know it sounds kind of romper room, but I really did. All of a sudden, here I was, you know, with the sense of, I'm welcoming my dear friends to sit next to me at the movie. And all of that sense of, you know, being uptight and judgment and all of that washed away. And then so the body softened and relaxed even more. And then, amazingly, there was just this sense of joy. Because it was like, look at what happened with that aversion in like 2 seconds, you know, probably less, that all this happened. So it can be done in a snap. It can also be done, it can be done in a therapeutic way. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Hakomi, body-centered psychotherapy, but you can follow sensation. You can get in touch with an issue, follow the sensation, you know, connect with the aliveness of it in the body, and then you just follow the flow and see, you know, any images or thoughts that come up in relationship to it, but really you're staying in contact with the flow of sensorial experience and just allowing your body to be a healing container for this energy. And, you know, it can come to extraordinary resolutions. So sometimes, though, in doing that, you'll hit a spot that's heavily defended, very opaque and murky, heavy, whatever, dense. And that's a moment at which you can, you know, feel your heart space. And then, you know, what is the heart's guidance? And that guidance, by the way, it might be, you know, it might be in the form of an external response, what to do in this situation. It might be how to take care of yourself, internal resourcing, an internal response. Or it might be what's the lesson to be learned, you know, from this. So so it can be done, you know, in a moment. You can do that, and I find that that's a way of softening those dragon scales, those defenses. It works pretty well. I'm actually exploring that now with a licensed therapist. I'm not a licensed therapist, but she and I are developing a 6-week training around heart fluency, and we'll use Ask Love as kind of the homework platform where you'll do journal entries, and you know, and we'll really explore the practice, you know, very much in depth, and there'll be a certification. And but it's a very, very powerful basic human capacity to tap into the wisdom of the heart. And, you know, when I think of our practice, I know I'm taking a long time to answer this, teacheritis, but, you know, with our practice, with mindfulness, anytime you show up, presence is something that is going to positively impact anything and everything you could possibly do in your life. And then when you string those moments of mindfulness, of presence together, the mind becomes unified and collected, concentrated, mm-hmm. focused. Presence and focus are something that will positively impact anything you could possibly do in your life. Being informed by your heart's sensibility in the moment positively informs anything and everything you could possibly do in your life. And so I loved it. John Travis said at a teacher committee meeting about a year ago, he said, you know, we use a form to move beyond the form. And at the differing levels of insight, we go from conceptual to experiential to completely embodied. You know, we kind of become it. And so with heart fluency or stop, drop, and ask, you know, the more you do it, the more that heart quality is starting to come in and inform you moment by moment. So you use that form, and then you move beyond that form to a place where you're heart informed, you know. And it's, to me, for me, having been kind of a head type, it's been a helpful balance, because I came from kind of a wisdom, you know, awareness up here. And over time in practice, you know, it kind of moved down here and then out to everything. So it's, yeah. Rich question. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anyone else? Oh, hey, Rich.
Are you using love as shorthand for all of the qualities of the heart, or the positive qualities of the heart, or the four Brahma Viharas, or kind of how are you, you know, behind the scenes framing that in your own practice?
Yeah. you know, there's a couple of ways. I would say a friend of mine had a definition for love, which was the impetus to unity. And I would say that for me, a big part of love is a lack of a sense of separation and a sense of unity, a sense of connectedness and caring. So out of that, I think that, you know, you get the basis for equanimity and all of the Brahma Viharas. So I use love as a broader term, but I actually, there's a very beautiful quote from Jack Kornfield that resonates for me. I think this is from A Path with Heart. And so this has a lot of those elements in it. I don't know if it's necessarily a definition, but I'll go ahead and read it anyway. But does that answer your question at some level? Yeah, so love creates a communion with life. Love expands us, connects us, sweetens us, ennobles us. Love springs up in tender concern. It blossoms into caring actions. It makes beauty out of all we touch. In any moment, we can step beyond our small self and embrace each other as beloved parts of a whole. And so that, to me, speaks very much of that sense of union and unity. And, you know, underneath a sense of the greed and aversion prior to, at some level, a necessary condition for greed and aversion is a sense of separation. If I'm separate, there's something to defend. There's something to protect. And the way I protect it is to get more of what I like and keep away what I don't like. And that's, you know, the main strategy of most of humanity. And that's why we're so neurotic on a global level. So when to me personally, the source of all of our ills is this core, basic, primal wound of a sense of separation. And whether that happens at parturition or whether it happens, I think that, you know, when I think about a little baby and they have no words, they have no concepts, they're just, you know, I don't know how they did this, but they determined that a newborn infant does not see the breast as other than itself. So there's really just, you know, experience happening and being known without, you know, any inside or outside. And but at some point, you know, something shocking or painful, you know, happens, or it happens enough times, and then there's this sense of protection is needed, you know, and a sense of me and, you know, there's me here and that out there, and I've got to protect myself from that out there at some level, starts to begin to just a basis for that forms, and then experience accretes onto that like stalactites. And then we get this big old thing, you know, the star of the movie, me, I, mine. And we're off to the suffering races. So I think I've got time for another question here. Thank you. So, here we go.
Thank you for talking about your constriction, and that it's, for an advanced practitioner, I see that it's still there.
Oh.
And that it's, and I'm struck by, for lack of a better word, sort of your faith that will shift, and that's pretty, and I may be misquoting you, but that in that faith that it will shift, lies the potential for it shifting, I think.
Yes.
And even when you can't feel it, and it may go on forever, and or feel like it's going on, because I found when those things happen to me, I tend to try to figure it out.
Mm.
Instead of just or I just sit back and go, well, that's the way it is. Instead of going, all right, this is the way it is, and it will shift, and then I'll know, and then
yeah. Oh, wonderful. Well, and I mean, I think you really encapsulated how I feel about it. And, you know, it's, I think one of the important things with any of the practices that we use, whether it's RAIN or, you know, heart fluency, stop, drop, and ask, or whatever technique, it's just to be really careful with that, that we're using that in a way like, I'm going to do stop, drop, and ask, and that's going to make this go away, you know? Or I'm going to do RAIN and it's going to get out of here. I'm going to RAIN it to death. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really about using those practices to, in a truly intimate way, the way you would hold a child, a sobbing child, on your lap and just let it be there. You know, and let it sob itself out. You know, and just to have the patience and go, you know what? You're the most important thing in the world right now. You take all the time you want. It's okay for you to be the way you are. You know, and as an adult, I'm going to hold you until, you know, I'm going to hold you for the rest of my life if I have to, and it's okay. Thank you. So, do you typically end with a couple minutes of metta, moments of metta, since I've kind of gone on? So I just invite you to bring any more comfort to your seated position that you can, and close your eyes if it feels good. really just taking a moment to appreciate yourself for coming to sit and share in the Dharma, hear the Dharma. That you did this to give yourself and your community a gift of healing, well-being, of taking care of yourself. That is a rich thing to do. And we can take great comfort and gratitude and a sense of warmth that we care for ourselves. We attend to our precious lives, meet them with the dignity of our presence. And just taking a moment to allow your attention to rest in the space of your heart, this home of our loving awareness. And see if you can feel any kind of a sense of warmth or goodness, your basic goodness. No need for words, just the feeling of the good heart itself. How do you know you have a heart? Not the physical or the affective romantic heart, but the heart is the seat of caring and clarity. And if you get a sense of that warmth or maybe a sense of expansiveness, if you don't, that's fine. That's what's true in the moment. That's what needs to be held in the moment. If you do get a sense of that warmth or expansiveness or something, metta, such a beautiful word, metta, a sense of a friendliness rising out of the still calm of a mind and heart that accept all the clouds, metta, friendliness, inclusivity, kindness. Imagine extending that to all throughout your body. From head to toe. Every cell infused with your own basic nature, your own basic goodness. And then imagine extending that as a sphere around yourself, above and below, on all four sides. And extending that out to the person next to you, and to the Sangha here in this room. Out to Sacramento, to California, the United States. The whole Western Hemisphere. Over to Asia and the Eastern Hemisphere, and encompassing our entire planet with friendliness and well-wishing kindness. This planet that so dearly needs our goodness right now, our ability to ask love, and recognizing that the heart, this quality, our awareness holds everything. This entire universe is held within our loving awareness, extending those well wishes out to all that is. May all beings everywhere be truly happy, and may they enjoy the benefits and the merit of our practice. Thank you. you so much for your practice, your kind attention.